4. Richie Tozier makes tracks. Well, there's the day Henry and his friends chased me. Before the end of school, this was. Richie was walking along Outer Canal Street past Bassey Park. Now he stopped, hands stuffed in his pockets, looking toward the kissing bridge, but not really seeing it. I get away from them in the toy department of Freezes. Since the mad conclusion of the reunion lunch, he had been walking aimlessly, trying to make his peace with the awful things which had been in the fortune cookies, or the things which had seemed to be in the cookies. He thought that most likely nothing at all had come out of them. It had been a group hallucination, brought on by all the spooky shit they had been talking about. The best proof of the hypothesis was that Rose had seen nothing at all. Of course, Beverly's parents had never seen any of the blood that came out of the bathroom drain either, but this wasn't the same. No? Why not? Because we're grown-ups now, he muttered, and discovered the thought had absolutely no power or logic at all. It might as well have been a nonsense line from a kid's skip rope chant. He started to walk again. I went up by City Center and sat down on a park bench for a while, and I thought I saw. He stopped again, frowning. Saw what? That was just something I dreamed. Was it? Was it really? He looked to the left and saw the big glass brick and steel building that had looked so modern in the late 50s and now looked rather antique and tacky. And here I am, he thought, right back to fucking City Center, scene of that other hallucination, or dream, or whatever it was. The others saw him as the class clown, the crazy cut-up. And he had fallen neatly and easily into that role again. Ah, we all fell neatly and easily back into our old roles again, didn't you notice? But was there anything very unusual about that? He thought you would probably see much the same thing at any 10th or 20th high school reunion. The class comedian, who had discovered a vocation for the priesthood in college, would, after two drinks, revert almost automatically to the wiseacre he had been. The great English brain, who had wound up with a GM truck dealership, would suddenly begin spouting off about John Irving or John Cheever, the guy who had played with the Moondogs on Saturday nights, and who had gone on to become a mathematics professor at Cornell, would suddenly find himself on stage with the band, a Fender guitar strapped over his shoulder, whopping out Gloria or Surfin' Bird with gleeful, drunken ferocity. What was it Springsteen said? No retreat, baby, no surrender. But it was easier to believe in the oldies on the record player after a couple of drinks or some pretty good Panama Red. But, Richie believed, it was the reversion that was the hallucination, not the present life. Maybe the child was the father of the man, but fathers and sons often shared very different interests and only a passing resemblance. They, but you say grown-ups, and now it sounds like nonsense. Sounds like so much bibble-babble. Why is that, Richie? Why? Because Derry is as weird as ever. Why don't we just leave it at that? Because things weren't that simple. That was why. As a kid, he had been a goof-off, a sometimes vulgar, sometimes amusing comedian, because it was one way to get along without getting killed by kids like Henry Bowers or going absolutely Looney Tunes with boredom and loneliness. He realized now that a lot of the problem had been his own mind, which was usually moving at a speed 10 or 20 times that of his classmates. They had thought him strange, weird, or even suicidal, depending on the escapade in question. But maybe it had been a simple case of mental overdrive. If anything about being in constant mental overdrive was simple. Anyway, it was the sort of thing you got under control after a while. You got it under control, or you found outlets for it, guys like Kinky Briefcase or Buford Kissdrivel, for instance. Richie had discovered that in the months after he had wandered into the college radio station pretty much on a whim and had discovered everything he had ever wanted during his first week behind the microphone. He hadn't been very good at first. He had been too excited to be good. But he had understood his potential not to be just good at the job, but great at it. And just that knowledge had been enough to put him over the moon on a cloud of euphoria. At the same time, he had begun to understand the great principle that moved the universe. At least that part of the universe which had to do with careers and success. You found the crazy guy who was running around inside of you, fucking up your life. You chased him into a corner and grabbed him, but you didn't kill him. Oh no, killing was too good for the likes of that little bastard. You put a harness over his head and then started plowing. The crazy guy worked like a demon once you had him in the traces, and he supplied you with a few chucks from time to time. That was really all there was, and that was enough. He'd been funny, all right, a laugh a minute, but in the end, he had outgrown the nightmares that were on the dark side of all those laughs, or he thought he had, until today when the word grown-up suddenly stopped making sense to his own ears. And now here was something else to cope with, or at least to think about. Here was the huge and totally idiotic statue of Paul Bunyan in front of the city center. I must be the exception that proves the rule, Big Bill. Are you sure there was nothing, Richie, nothing at all? Up by city center, I thought I saw. Sharp pain needled at his eyes for the second time that day, and he clutched at them, a startled moan coming out of him. Then it was gone again as quickly as it had come. But he had also smelled something, hadn't he? Something that wasn't really there, but something that had been there, something that made him think of. I'm right here with you, Richie. Hold my hand. Can you catch hold? Mike Hanlon. It was smoke that had made his eyes sting and water. 27 years ago, they had breathed that smoke. In the end, there had just been Mike and himself left, and they had seen, but it was gone. He took a step closer to the plastic Paul Bunyan statue, as amazed by its cheerful vulgarity now as he had been overwhelmed by its size as a child. The mythical Paul stood 20 feet high, and the base added another 6 feet. He stood smiling down at the car and pedestrian traffic on Outer Canal Street from the edge of the city center lawn. City Center had been erected in the years 1954-55 for a minor league basketball team that had never materialized. The Derry City Council had voted money for the statue a year later in 1956. It had been hotly debated both in the council's public meetings and in the letters to the editor columns of the Derry News. Many thought it would be a perfectly lovely statue, certain to become a tourist attraction of note. There were others who found the idea of a plastic Paul Bunyan horrible, garish, and unbelievably gauche. The art teacher at Derry High School, Richie remembered, had written a letter to the News saying that if such a monstrosity were actually to be erected in Derry, she would blow it up. Grinning, Richie wondered if that babe's contract had been renewed. The controversy, which Richie recognized now as an utterly typical big-town, small-city tempest in a teapot, had raged for 6 months, and of course, it had been entirely meaningless. The statue had been purchased, and even if the city council had done something as aberrant, especially for New England, as deciding not to use an item for which money had been paid, where in God's name could it have been stored? Then the statue, not really sculpted at all, but simply cast in some Ohio plastics plant, had been set in place, still shrouded in a whack of canvas big enough to serve as a clipper ship sail. It had been unveiled on May 13, 1957, which was the Incorporated Township's 150th birthday. One faction gave voice to predictable moans of outrage, the other to equally predictable moans of rapture. When Paul was revealed that day, he was wearing his bib overalls and a red and white checked shirt. His beard was splendidly black, splendidly full, splendidly lumberjack-y. A plastic axe, surely the Godzilla of all plastic axes, was slung over one shoulder, and he grinned unceasingly at the northern skies, which, on the day of the unveiling, had been as blue as the skin of Paul's reputed companion. Babe was not present at the unveiling, however. The cost estimate of adding a blue ox to the tableau had been prohibitive. The children who attended the ceremonies, there were hundreds of them, and 10-year-old Richie Tozier, in the company of his dad, had been among them, were totally and uncritically delighted by the plastic giant. Parents boosted toddlers up onto the square pedestal on which Paul stood, took photos, and then watched with mixed apprehension and amusement as the kids climbed and crawled, laughing over Paul's huge black boots. Correction, huge black plastic boots. It had been March of the following year when Richie, exhausted and terrified, had finished up on one of the benches in front of the statue after eluding, by the barest of margins, Messrs. Bowers, Chris, and Huggins, in a chase that had led from Derry Elementary School across most of the downtown area. He had finally ditched them in the toy department of Freeze's department store. The Derry branch of Freeze's was a poor thing compared with the grand downtown department store in Bangor. But Richie had been far past caring about such things. By then, it was a case of any port in a storm. Henry Bowers had been right behind him, and by then Richie had been flagging badly. He had dodged into the mouth of the department store's revolving door as a last resort. Henry, who apparently didn't understand the physics of such devices, had nearly lost the tips of his fingers trying to grab Richie as Richie trundled around and into the store. Pelting downstairs, shirt tail flying out behind him, he had heard the revolving door give off a series of reports almost as loud as TV gunfire, and understood that Larry, Moe, and Curly were still after him. He was laughing as he went down the stairs to the basement level, but that was only a nervous tic. He was as full of terror as a rabbit caught in a wire snare. They really meant to beat him up good this time. He had no idea that in another 10 weeks or so, he would believe the three of them, Henry in particular, capable of anything short of murder, and he surely would have whitened with shock if he had known of the apocalyptic rock fight in July, when even that last qualification would disappear from his mind. And the whole thing had been so utterly, typically stupid. Richie and the other boys in his fifth-grade class had been filing into the gym. A sixth-grade class, Henry hulking among them like an ox among cows, had been coming out. Although he was still in the fifth grade, Henry went to gym with the older boys. The overhead pipes had been dripping again, and Mr. Fazio hadn't yet gotten around to putting up his "Caution, wet floor" sign on its little easel. Henry had slipped in a puddle and had landed on his keister. Before he could stop it, Richie's traitor mouth had bugled, "Way to go, banana heels!" There had been an explosion of laughter from both Henry's classmates and Richie's, but there had been no laughter on Henry's face as he picked himself up, only a dull flush the color of freshly fired brick. "Later for you, Four Eyes," he said, and walked on. The laughter died at once. The boys in the hall looked at Richie as one already dead. Henry did not pause to check reactions. He simply walked off, head down, elbows red from catching the fall, a large wet place on the seat of his pants. Looking at that wet spot, Richie felt his suicidally witty mouth drop open again, but this time he snapped it shut again, so fast he almost amputated the tip of his tongue with the falling gait of his teeth. "Well, but he'll forget," he told himself uneasily as he changed up for gym. "Sure he will. Old Hank just hasn't got that many memory circuits working. Every time he takes a shit, he probably has to look up the directions in the instruction booklet. Ha ha! Ha ha." "You're dead, trash mouth," Vince Boogers Taliendo told him, pulling his jock up over a dork roughly the size and shape of an anemic peanut. He said it with a certain sad respect. "Don't worry, though. I'll bring flowers." "Cut off your ears and bring cauliflowers," Richie had come back smartly, and everyone laughed. Even old Boogers Taliendo laughed. Why not? They could all afford to laugh. What, me worry? They would all be home watching Jimmy Dodd and the Mouseketeers on the Mickey Mouse Club, or Frankie Lyman singing "I'm Not a Juvenile Delinquent" on American Bandstand, while Richie went shagging ass through ladies' lingerie and housewares on his way to the toy department, with sweat pouring down his back into the crack of his ass, and his terrified balls strung up so high they felt like they might be hung over his belly button. Sure, they could laugh. Hardy, har, har, har. Henry hadn't forgotten. Richie had left by the door at the kindergarten end of the school building just in case, but Henry had stuck Belch Huggins there, also just in case. Hardy, har, har, har. Richie saw Belch first, or there would have been no contest at all. Belch was looking out toward Derry Park, holding an unlit cigarette in one hand and dreamily picking the seat of his chinos out of his ass with the other. Heart pounding hard, Richie had walked quietly across the playground and was most of the way down Charter Street before Belch turned his head and saw him. He yelled for Henry and Victor, and since then the chase had been on. When Richie reached the toy department, it had been utterly, horribly deserted. There wasn't even a sales clerk hanging out, a welcome adult to put a stop to things before they got entirely out of hand. He could hear the three dinosaurs of the apocalypse closing in now, and he simply couldn't run anymore. Each breath produced a deep, hurting stitch in his left side. His eye fixed on a door which read, "Emergency exit only, alarm will sound." Hope kindled in his chest. Richie ran down an aisle crammed with Donald Duck jack-in-the-boxes, United States Army tanks made in Japan, Lone Ranger cap pistols, wind-up robots. He reached the door and slammed the push bar as hard as he could. The door opened, letting in cool mid-March air. The alarm went off with a strident bray. Richie immediately doubled back and dropped to his hands and knees in the next aisle over. He was down before the door could settle closed again. Henry, Belch, and Victor thundered into the toy department just as the door clicked shut and the alarm cut off. They raced for it, Henry in the lead, his face set and intent. A sales clerk finally appeared, coming on the run. He wore a blue nylon duster over a plaid sport coat of excruciating ugliness. The rims of his spectacles were as pink as the eyes of a white rabbit. Richie thought he looked like Wally Cox in his Mr. Peepers role, and he had to slam his traitor mouth into the fat part of his forearm to keep from screaming out gales of exhausted laughter. "You boys!" Mr. Peepers exclaimed. "You boys can't go out there! That's an emergency exit! You! Hey! You boys!" Victor glanced at him a little nervously, but Henry and Belch never turned from their course, and Victor followed them. The alarm brayed again, longer this time as they charged into the alley. Before it stopped clanging, Richie was on his feet and trotting back toward ladies' lingerie.
"You boys will be barred from the store!" the clerk yelled after him.
Looking back over his shoulder, Richie squealed in his granny grunt voice,
"Did anyone ever tell you you look just like Mr. Peepers, young man?"
And so he had escaped. And so he had finished up almost a mile from Freeze's in front of City Center, and, he devoutly hoped, out of harm's way. At least for the time being. He was spent. He sat down on a bench just to the left of the Paul Bunyan statue, wanting only a little peace while he got himself back together. In a bit, he would get up and head home. But for now, it felt too good to just sit here in the afternoon sun. The day had opened in a cold, drizzly gloom, but now you could believe spring might actually be on the way. Farther up the lawn, he could see the City Center marquee, which on that March day bore this message in large, blue, translucent letters. "Hey, teens! Coming March 28th, the Arnie Woo Woo Ginsburg Rock and Roll Show! Jerry Lee Lewis, the Penguins, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, Gene Vincent and the Blue Caps, Freddie Boom Boom Cannon, an evening of wholesome entertainment." That was a show Richie really wanted to see, but he knew there wasn't a chance. His mother's idea of wholesome entertainment did not include Jerry Lee Lewis telling the young people of America, "We got chicken in the barn, whose barn, what barn, my barn," nor for that matter, did it include Freddie Cannon, whose Tallahassee Lassie had a hi-fi chassis. She was willing to admit that she had done her share of screaming for Frank Sinatra, whom she now called Frankie the Snot, as a Bobby Soxer, but, like Bill Denbrough's mother, she was death on rock and roll. Chuck Berry terrified her, and she declared that Richard Penniman, better known to his teen and sub-teen constituency as Little Richard, made her want to barf like a chicken. This was a phrase for which Richie had never asked a translation. His dad was neutral on the subject of rock and roll, and could perhaps have been swayed, but Richie knew in his heart that his mother's wishes would rule on this subject, until he was 16 or 17 anyway, and by then, his mother was firmly convinced the country's rock and roll mania would have passed. Richie thought Danny and the Juniors were more right on that subject than his mom. Rock and roll would never die. He himself loved it, although his sources were really only two, American Bandstand on Channel 7 in the afternoon, and WMEX out of Boston at night, when the air had thinned and the hoarse, enthusiastic voice of Arnie Ginsburg came wavering in and out like the voice of a ghost called up at a seance. The beat did more than make him happy. It made him feel bigger, stronger, more there. When Frankie Ford sang Sea Cruise or Eddie Cochran sang Summertime Blues, Richie was actually transported with joy. There was power in that music, a power which seemed to most rightfully belong to all the skinny kids, fat kids, ugly kids, shy kids, the world's losers, in short. In it, he felt a mad, hilarious voltage which had the power to both kill and exalt. He idolized Fats Domino, who made even Ben Hanscom look slim and trim, and Buddy Holly, who, like Richie, wore glasses, and screaming Jay Hawkins, who popped out of a coffin at his concerts, or so Richie had been told, and the Davels, who danced as good as black guys. Well, almost. He would have his rock and roll someday if he wanted it. He was confident it would still be there for him when his mother finally gave in and let him have it. But that would not be on March 28th, 1958, or in 1959, or His eyes had drifted away from the marquee, and then... well, then he must have fallen asleep. It was the only explanation that made sense. What had happened next could only happen in dreams. And now here he was again, a Richie Tozier who had finally gotten all the rock and roll he had ever wanted, and who had found, happily, that it still wasn't enough. His eyes went to the marquee in front of City Center and saw that, with a hideous kind of serendipity, those same blue letters spelled out, "June 14th, Heavy Metal Mania, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden. Buy your tickets here or at any Ticketron outlet." Somewhere along the way, they dropped the wholesome entertainment line, but as far as I can tell, that's just about the only difference, Richie thought. And heard Danny and the Juniors dim and distant, like voices heard down a long corridor coming out of a cheap radio. "Rock and roll will never die, I'll dig it to the end. It'll go down in history, just you watch, my friend." Richie looked back at Paul Bunyan, patron saint of Derry. Derry, which had come into being, according to the stories, because this was where the logs fetched up when they came downriver. There had been a time when, in the spring, both the Penobscot and the Kanduskeag would have been solid logs from one side to the other, their black bark hides glistening in the spring sun. A fellow who was fast on his feet could walk from Wally's Spa in Hell's Half Acre over to Rampers in Brewster. Rampers was a tavern of such horrible repute that it was commonly called the Bucket of Blood, without getting his boots wet over the third crossing of his rawhide laces. Or so it had been storied in Richie's youth. And he supposed there was a bit of Paul Bunyan in all such stories. "Old Paul," he thought, looking up at the plastic statue. "What you been doing since I've been gone? Made any new riverbeds, coming home tired and dragging your axe behind you? Made any new lakes, on account of wanting a bathtub big enough so you could sit in water up to your neck? Scared any more little kids, the way you scared me that day?" Ah. And suddenly, he remembered it all. The way you will sometimes suddenly remember a word which has been dancing on the tip of your tongue. There he had been, sitting in that mellow March sunshine, drowsing a little, thinking about going home and catching the last half hour of bandstand, and suddenly there had been a warm swash of air into his face. It blew his hair back from his forehead. He looked up, and Paul Bunyan's huge plastic face had been right in front of his, bigger than a face on a movie screen, filling everything. The rush of air had been caused by Paul's bending down. Although he did not precisely look like Paul anymore, the forehead was now low and beetling. Tufts of wiry hair poked from a nose as red as the nose of a longtime drunkard. His eyes were bloodshot, and one had a slight cast to it. The axe was no longer on his shoulder. Paul was leaning on its haft, and the blunt end of its head had crushed a trench in the concrete of the sidewalk. He was still grinning, but there was nothing cheery about it now. From between gigantic yellow teeth, there drifted a smell like small animals rotting in hot underbrush.
"I'm going to eat you up,"
the giant had said, in a low, rumbling voice. It was the sound of boulders rocking against each other during an earthquake.
"Unless you give me back my hen and my harp and my bags of gold, I'm going to eat you right the fuck up."
The breath of these words made Richie's shirt flutter and flap like a sail in a hurricane. He shrank back against the bench, eyes bugging, hair standing out to all sides like quills, wrapped in a pocket of carrion stink. The giant began to laugh. It settled its hands on the haft of its axe the way Ted Williams might have laid hold of his favorite baseball bat, or ash handle, if you prefer, and pulled it out of the hole it had made in the sidewalk. The axe began to rise into the air. It made a low, lethal rushing sound. Richie suddenly understood that the giant meant to split him right down the middle. But he felt that he could not move. A logy sort of apathy had stolen over him. What did it matter? He was dozing, having a dream. Any moment now, some driver would blow his horn at a kid running across the street, and he would wake up.
"That's right," the giant had rumbled. "You'll wake up in hell."
And at the last instant, as the axe slowed to its apogee and balanced there, Richie understood that this wasn't a dream at all, and if it was, it was a dream that could kill.
Trying to scream but making no sound at all, he rolled off the bench and onto the raked gravel plot which surrounded what had been a statue, and was now only a base with two huge steel bolts sticking out of it where the feet had been. The sound of the descending axe filled the world with its pressing, insistent whisper. The giant's grin had become a murderer's grimace. Its lips had pulled back so far from its teeth that its plastic red gums, hideously red, gleamed. The blade of the axe struck the bench where Richie had been only an instant before. The edge was so sharp that there was almost no sound at all, but the bench was sheared instantly in two. The halves sagged away from each other. The wood inside the green-painted skin a bright and somehow sickening white. Richie was on his back. Still trying to scream, he pushed himself with his heels. Gravel went down the collar of his shirt, down the back of his pants, and there was Paul, towering above him, looking down at him with eyes the size of manhole covers. There was Paul, looking down at one small boy cowering on the gravel. The giant took a step toward him. Richie felt the ground shudder when the black boot came down. Gravel spumed up in a cloud. Richie rolled over onto his stomach and staggered to his feet. His legs were already trying to run before he was balanced, and as a result he fell flat on his belly again. He heard the wind woof out of his lungs. His hair fell in his eyes. He could see the traffic going back and forth on Canal and Main Street, as it did every day, as if nothing was happening, as if no one in any of those cars could see or care that Paul Bunyan had come to life and stepped down from its pedestal in order to commit murder with an axe roughly the size of a deluxe motorhome. The sunshine was blotted out. Richie lay in a patch of shade that looked like a man. He scrambled to his knees, almost fell over sideways, managed to get to his feet, and ran as fast as he could. He ran with his knees popping almost all the way up to his chest and his elbows pistoning. Behind him, he could hear that awful, persistent whisper building again, a sound that seemed to be not really sound at all, but pressure on the skin and eardrums. Swoop! The earth shook. Richie's upper and lower teeth rattled against each other like china plates in an earthquake. He did not have to look to know that Paul's axe had buried itself half deep in the sidewalk, inches behind his feet. Madly, in his mind, he heard the Devells. Oh, the kids in Bristol are sharp as a pistol when they do the Bristol stomp. He passed out of the giant's shadow into sunlight again, and as he did, he began to laugh, the same exhausted laughter that had come from him when he bolted downstairs in freezes, panting, that hot stitch in his side again. He had, at last, risked a glance back over his shoulder. There was the statue of Paul Bunyan, standing on its pedestal where it always stood, axe on its shoulder, head cocked toward the sky, lips parted in the eternal optimistic grin of the myth hero. The bench, which had been sheared in two, was whole and intact, thank you very much. The gravel where Tall Paul, he's my all, Annette Funicello sang maniacally in Richie's head, had planted his huge foot, was raked and immaculate, except for the scuffed spot where Richie had fallen off while he was, getting away from the giant, dreaming. There was no footprint, no axe slash in the concrete. There was nothing here but a boy who'd been chased by other boys, bigger boys, and so had had himself a very small but very potent dream about a homicidal colossus, the giant economy-size Henry Bowers, if you pleased. Shit, Richie said in a tiny, wavering voice, and then uttered an uncertain laugh. He stood there a while longer, waiting to see if the statue would move again, perhaps wink, perhaps shift its axe from one shoulder to the other, perhaps come down and have at him again. But of course none of those things happened. Of course. What, me worry? Hardy har har har. A doze, a dream, no more than that. But, as Abraham Lincoln or Socrates or someone like that had once observed, enough was enough. It was time to go home and cool out, to make like Kooky on 77 Sunset Strip and just lay chilly. And although it would have been quicker to cut through the city center grounds, he decided not to. He didn't want to get close to that statue again. So he had gone the long way around, and by that evening, he had nearly forgotten the incident. Until now. Here sits a man, he thought. Here sits a man dressed in a mossy green sport coat purchased at one of the best shops on Rodeo Drive. Here sits a man with Bass Weegans on his feet and Calvin Klein underwear to cover his ass. Here sits a man with soft contact lenses resting easily on his eyes. Here sits a man remembering the dream of a boy who thought an Ivy League shirt with a Fruit Loop on the back and a pair of snapjack shoes was the height of fashion. Here sits a grown-up, looking at the same old statue, and hey, Paul, tall Paul, I'm here to say you're the same in every way. You ain't aged a motherfucking day. The old explanation still rang true in his mind, a dream. He supposed he could believe in monsters if he had to. Monsters were no big deal. Hadn't he sat in radio studios at one time or another, reading news copy about such fellows as Idi Amin Dada and Jim Jones and that guy who had blown away all those folks in a McDonald's just down the road a piece? Shit fire and save matches. Monsters were cheap. Who needed a $5 movie ticket when you could read about them in the paper for 35 cents or hear about them on the radio for free? And he supposed, if he could believe in the Jim Jones variety, he could believe in Mike Hanlon's version, at least for a while. It even had its own sorry charm, because it came from outside, and no one had to claim responsibility for it. He could believe in a monster that had as many faces as there are rubber masks in a novelty shop. If you're going to have one, you might as well have a pack of them, he thought. Cheaper by the dozen, right, gang? At least for the sake of argument. But a 30-foot-high plastic statue that stepped off its pedestal and then tried to carve you up with its plastic axe? That was just a little too ripe. As Abraham Lincoln or Socrates or someone had also said, I'll eat fish and I'll eat meat, but there is some shit I will not eat. It just wasn't... That sharp, needling pain struck his eyes again, without warning, jerking a dismayed cry from him. This was the worst yet, going deeper and lasting longer, scaring the bejesus out of him. He clapped his hands to his eyes and then groped instinctively for the bottom lids with his forefingers, meaning to pop his contacts out. It's maybe some kind of infection, he thought dimly, but Jesus, it hurts. He pulled the lids down and was ready to give the single practiced blink that would send them tumbling out, and he would spend the next 50 minutes groveling myopically for them in the gravel surrounding the bench, but Jesus God, who gave a shit? Right now it felt like there were nails in his eyes. When the pain disappeared. It did not dwindle, it just went. One moment there, the next moment gone. His eyes teared briefly and then stopped. He lowered his hands slowly, his heart running fast in his chest, ready to blink them out the instant the pain started again. It didn't. And suddenly, he found himself thinking about the only horror movie that had ever really scared him as a kid, possibly because he'd taken so much shit about his glasses and had spent so much time thinking about his eyes. That movie had been The Crawling Eye with Forrest Tucker. Not very good. The other kids had laughed themselves into hysterics over it, but Richie had not laughed. Richie had been rendered cold and white and dumb for once, with not a single voice to command, as that gelatinous, tentacled eye came out of the manufactured fog of some English movie set, waving its fibrous tentacles in front of it. The sight of that eye had been very bad, the embodiment of 100 not-quite-realized fears and disquiets. On some night not long after, he had dreamed of looking at himself in a mirror, and bringing a large pin up and sticking it slowly into the black iris of his eye, and feeling a numb, watery springiness as the bottom of his eye filled up with blood. He remembered, now he remembered, waking up and discovering that he had wet the bed. The best indicator of how gruesome that dream had been was that his primary feeling had not been shame at his nocturnal indiscretion, but relief. He had embraced the warm, wet patch with his body and blessed the reality of his sight. Fuck this, Richie Tozier said in a low voice that was not quite steady, and started to get up. He would go back to the Derry townhouse and take a nap. If this was Memory Lane, he preferred the L.A. freeway at rush hour. The pain in his eyes was probably no more than a signal of exhaustion and jet lag, plus the stress of meeting the past all at once, in one afternoon. Enough shocks, enough exploring. He didn't like the way his mind was skittering from one subject to the next. What was that Peter Gabriel tune? Shock the Monkey. Well, this monkey had been shocked enough. It was time to catch some Z's and maybe gain a little perspective. As he rose, his eyes went to the marquee in front of City Center again. All at once, the strength ran out of his legs, and he sat down again. Hard. Richie Tozier, man of 1,000 voices, returns to Derry, land of 1,000 dances. In honor of Trash Mouth's return, City Center proudly presents the Richie Tozier All Dead Rock Show. Buddy Holly, Richie Valens, The Big Bopper, Frankie Lyman, Gene Vincent, Marvin Gaye, House Band, Jimi Hendrix lead guitar, John Lennon rhythm guitar, Phil Lynott bass guitar, Keith Moon drums, special guest vocalist Jim Morrison. Welcome home, Richie. You're dead too. He felt as if someone had whopped all the breath out of him. And then he heard that sound again. That sound that was half pressure on the skin and eardrums, that keen, homicidal, whispering rush. Swip! He rolled off the bench onto the gravel, thinking, so this is what they mean by deja vu. Now you know. You'll never have to ask anybody again. He hit on his shoulder and rolled, looking up at the Paul Bunyan statue, only it was no longer Paul Bunyan. The clown stood there instead, resplendent and evident, fantastic in plastic, 20 feet of day-glow colors, its painted face surmounting a cosmic comic ruff. Orange pom-pom buttons cast in plastic, each as big as a volleyball, ran down the front of the silvery suit. Instead of an axe, it held a huge bunch of plastic balloons. Engraved on each were two legends. It's Still Rock and Roll to Me and Richie Tozier's All Dead Rock Show. He scrambled backward, using his heels and his palms. Gravel went down the back of his pants. He heard a seam tear loose in the underarm of his Rodeo Drive sport coat. He rolled over, gained his feet, staggered, looked back. The clown looked down at him. Its eyes rolled wetly in their sockets.
"Did I give you a scare, my man?" it rumbled.
And Richie heard his mouth say, quite independently of his frozen brain, "Cheap thrills in the back of my car, bozo, that's all." The clown grinned and nodded as if it had expected no more. Red, paint-bleeding lips parted to show teeth like fangs, each one coming to a razor point.
"I could have you now, if I wanted you now," it said. "But this is going to be too much fun."
"Fun for me, too," Richie heard his mouth say. "The most fun of all, when we come to take your fucking head off, baby." The clown's grin spread wider and wider. It raised one hand, clad in a white glove, and Richie felt the wind of the movement blow the hair off his forehead, as it had on that day 27 years ago. The clown's index finger popped out at him. It was as big as a beam. "Big as a bee," Richie thought. And then the pain struck again. It drove rusty spikes into the soft jelly of his eyes. He screamed and clutched at his face.
"Before removing the mote from thy neighbor's eye, attend the beam in thine own," the clown intoned, its words rumbling and vibrating, and Richie was again enveloped in the sweet stink of its carrion breath.
He looked up and took half a dozen hurried steps backward. The clown was bending down, its gloved hands on its gaily pantalooned knees.
"Want to play some more, Richie?
How about if I point at your pecker and give you prostate cancer? Or I could point at your head and give you a good old brain tumor, although I'm sure some people would say that would only be adding to what was already there. I could point at your mouth, and your stupid flapping tongue will turn into so much running pus. I can do it, Richie. Want to see?"
Its eyes were widening, widening. And in those black pupils, each as big as a softball, Richie saw the mad darkness that must exist over the rim of the universe. He saw a shitty happiness that he felt would drive him insane. In that moment, he understood it could do any of these things and more. And yet again, he heard his mouth. But this time, it was not his voice or any of his created voices, past or present. It was a voice he had never heard before. Later, he would tell the others, hesitantly, that it was a kind of Mr. Jive-ass nigger voice, loud and proud, self-parodying and screechy.
"Get off my case, you big old honky clown!" he shouted.
And suddenly he was laughing again.
"No shit, no shine, motherfucker! I got to walk, I got to talk, and I got the big popping cock. I got the time, I got the mind, and I'm a man with a plan. If you don't shit, you gon' shit. You hear me, you white-faced bunghole?"
Richie thought the clown recoiled, But he did not stick around to find out for sure. He ran, elbows pumping, sport coat flying out in wings behind him, not caring that a father who had stopped so his toddler could admire Paul was now staring warily at him, as if he had gone crazy. As a matter of fact, folks, Richie thought, I feel like I've gone crazy. Oh, God, do I ever. And that had to have been the shittiest Grandmaster Flash imitation in history, but somehow it did the trick. Somehow. And then the clown's voice thundered after him. The father of the little boy did not hear it, but the toddler's face suddenly pinched in upon itself, and he began to wail. The dad picked his son up and hugged him, bewildered. Even through his own terror, Richie observed this little sideshow closely. The voice of the clown was perhaps angrily gleeful, perhaps just angry.
We've got the eye down here, Richie, you hear me? The one that crawls. If you don't want to fly, don't want to say goodbye, you come on down under this here town and give a great big hi to one great big eye. You come down and see it any time. Just any old time you like, you hear me, Richie? Bring your yo-yo. Have Beverly wear a big full skirt with 4 or 5 petticoats underneath. Have her wear her husband's ring around her neck. Get Eddie to wear his saddle shoes. We'll play some bop, Richie. We'll play all the hits.
Reaching the sidewalk, Richie dared to look back over his shoulder, and what he saw was in no way comforting. Paul Bunyan was still gone, and now the clown was gone, too. Where they had stood there was now a 20-foot-high plastic statue of Buddy Holly. He was wearing a button on one of the narrow lapels of his plaid sport coat. Richie Tozier's All Dead Rock Show, the button read. One bow of Buddy's glasses had been mended with adhesive tape. The little boy was still crying hysterically. His father was walking rapidly back toward downtown with the weeping child in his arms. He gave Richie a wide berth. Richie got walking, feet don't fail me now, trying not to think about, we'll play all the hits, what had just happened. All he wanted to think about was the monster jolt of scotch he was going to have in the Derry Townhouse bar before he went up to take that nap. The thought of a drink, just your ordinary garden variety drink, made him feel a little better. He looked over his shoulder one more time, and the fact that Paul Bunyan was back, grinning at the sky, plastic axe over his shoulder, made him feel better still. Richie began to walk faster, making tracks, putting distance between himself and that statue. He'd even begun to think about the possibility of hallucinations when the pain struck his eyes again, deep and agonizing, causing him to cry out hoarsely. A pretty young girl who had been walking ahead of him, looking dreamily up at the breaking clouds, looked back at him, hesitated, then hurried over. Mister, are you all right? It's my contacts, he said in a strained voice. Madame Contact oh, my God, that hurts. This time he got his forefingers up so quickly he almost jabbed them into his eyes. He pulled down the lowered lids and thought, I won't be able to blink them out, that's what's going to happen. I won't be able to blink them out, and it's just going to go on hurting and hurting and hurting until I go blind, go blind, go blind. But one blink did it. As one blink always had. The sharp and defined world, where colors stayed inside the lines and where faces that you saw were clear and obvious, simply fell away. Wide bands of pastel fuzz took their place, and although he and the high school girl, who was both helpful and concerned, searched the paving of the sidewalk for almost 15 minutes, neither could find even a single lens. In the back of his head, Richie seemed to hear the clown laughing.